Welcome to Hack the Entrepreneur, the show which reveals the fears, habits, and inner battles behind big-name entrepreneurs and those on their way to joining them. Now here is your host, John Naster.
Hey, this is Hack the Entrepreneur. Thank you so much for joining me today. I am your host, John Naster, and I hope that you are doing well out there. In 2020, the year that keeps on giving, I will say, take that as you will. But yeah, it's great to have you back. And if this is your first time, welcome to the show. I hope you dig it. And with that said, let's get into the interview. Today's guest immigrated to the United States from the Ukraine in 1979. After graduating, his career began as a trial attorney, where he successfully spent 13 years representing clients in the intellectual property dispute arena. But then back in 2006, he stumbled across this opportunity while going about his day-to-day work. So for the past 14 years, he's been the founder and CEO of CrowdSpring. CrowdSpring, in case you don't know, CrowdSpring has helped to democratize design around the world. And they've helped connect over 220,000 creatives from around the world with more than 60,000 of the world's best entrepreneurs, small businesses, and agencies. So what began as an idea to scratch his own itch has turned into a pioneer and forerunner in the world of online design. Now, let's hack Ross Kimborowski. Let's stop and pretend for a moment that you're about to launch a campaign. It's tested well. Your team is completely happy. Everything is going according to plan, except for that one nagging thought in the back of your head. How do I ensure people I want to target will be in the mindset to receive my message? The answer? LinkedIn. Because when you market on LinkedIn, your message reaches people who are ready to do business. And that means your advertising campaign will work as hard as it can as soon as you launch it. And this works so well because over 62 million decision makers are on LinkedIn. And while they're there, they're thinking about their business. Doing business on LinkedIn, the world's largest professional network, can help you reach your marketing goals. Do business where business is done. Get a $100 advertising credit towards your first LinkedIn campaign. Visit linkedin.com/hack. That's linkedin.com/hack. Terms and conditions apply. And we are back with another episode of Hack the Entrepreneur. And today we have a very, very special guest. Ross, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, John. Happy to be here talking to you and your listeners.
Oh, man, I'm so happy to have you. And I've been looking forward to this call. So let's just jump straight into it. Ross, let's start here. As an entrepreneur, can you tell me what is the one thing that you do that you feel has been the biggest contributor to your successes so far?
Something we started pretty soon after we found CrowdSpring in 2006, we started working on CrowdSpring. We'll talk about what it is. But a couple of years into the process, it occurred to me that it was very challenging for us to understand the competition because we were very early in our market. And so there were competitors, but we were the innovator in our space. And so it was tough to challenge ourselves to compete against people when we didn't really know who we were competing against. So we did something a little different. Every quarter, every half year, I'd meet with my team, typically every quarter, to plan out the next quarter. And so we asked a simple question, and we continue to do this today, 10 years later. If we had to build a business to compete against ourselves, how would we build it in our space? And would we build it? Would we even want to compete against ourselves? Are we in a space that we care about? And that question let us every quarter, essentially on a whiteboard, look to redefine our business. And sometimes that's meant small changes or improving things that weren't necessarily obvious to us running the business, but when we took a bigger picture, became obvious. And sometimes, like in 2015, it meant a two-year complete overhaul of the entire business, everything, every pixel on the site, every marketing strategy and campaign, because we felt we reached a point where we ultimately could beat ourselves easily if we did something a little different in everything that we do. And we ended up doing that. So it's that question, how do we compete with ourselves if we had to build a business in the same space, that I think has helped us continue to be innovative at times when we haven't had competition, and also innovate at times where we've had, because we've had to also try to beat the competition.
I like this. I like this a lot, especially because of your position in the marketplace. There's, in the past 14 years, there's obviously been several massive shifts in the market from being the innovators to now. There's a ton of competition, I think, in your space. Does it involve you and your team to a certain degree, just ignoring the competition, just to continually compete with yourself and be the sort of leader and innovator in the space?
So there's a lot of advice about what you do with the competition. Some people say ignore it. Some people say obsessively look at them. Some people say pay attention. I used to heavily buy into this camp that say ignore the competition and just do what you want to do. And honestly, I have a hard time understanding how you can build a successful business while you do that. It's really tough to understand the market and to find a good product market fit if you are oblivious to what's actually happening in the market. And the competition is part of that. And so we've always paid attention to the competition, but not obsessively. So one of the mistakes that I think a lot of people make early on, and fortunately, it wasn't a mistake we made early on because we just wanted to do things differently. And in trying to apply this whiteboard principle every quarter, in trying to compete with ourselves, we just by luck avoided making this mistake. Some people will say, I'll look at the competition, I'll look at the features they have, and I'll try to replicate them. And the challenge is that it's almost impossible to compete on features. People, regardless of industry, very rarely focus on those kinds of things. And so you have to find different ways to compete. And that's why the best companies are ones that are aware of what the competition is doing. They're not ignorant of the competition. They don't obsess about the competition. They focus on their own business. They focus on trying to find their own path forward. So we pay attention. We've had hundreds of competitors come and go as we've been in our industry, in the crowdsourcing design and product design space over the last 14 plus years. And we take note of what they do, but one reason we've continued to stay innovative and continue to be one of the market leaders is by competing with ourselves. We are our own competition, and that has led us forward in a much more, I think, aggressive and creative way than if we had just paid attention to what others were doing.
So in the space, again, for the amount of time, you guys are an old company for online business at this point, which is awesome, but you've seen the changes. And so competing with yourself, and like, I love this, paying attention to your competition, but don't obsess about them. When you say that you're trying to like compete with yourself, are you trying to compete with, like, you have your next quarterly meeting, Ross, are you trying to compete with CrowdSpring today or CrowdSpring 6 months down the road, year down the road, 2 years? Like, what's sort of the forecasting and looking at that?
Well, first of all, I've never been able to forecast beyond the next 6 months. I just don't understand how most companies can do it. Big companies have a need to do that. They have to figure out budgets, and they have to figure out personnel, and they have to figure out big scale development. Smaller companies really have a hard time knowing what's going to happen in 6 months, much less a year or 2 years. So when we think about our future, we think about the next quarter, we think about maybe the next half year. And in some cases, if we're planning a new product, we might think a little bit longer, but really never beyond that year period. So when I say compete with ourselves, I mean literally that. If you and I were to today say, what can we do to beat CrowdSpring in the marketplace and the other competitors in the crowdsourcing design space? So we entered the market in 2008 when we publicly launched. And at the time, there was really nothing similar to this. There was 99 Designs, and there was CrowdSpring that launched within a couple of months of each other. And ultimately, you had these old style marketplaces like Elance that let anybody post an RFP, a request for proposals. Here's what I need done. And people started bidding on it, and you get all these bids, and then you pick the one you like. And that was the old model. It's been practiced for hundreds, thousands of years. It's how we normally hire service providers, but it isn't how we buy goods, not how we buy televisions, cars, motorcycles. And so we wanted to do something different. We wanted to change that model. And part of what we did then, which is what drove us to be asking this question every quarter, is we said, if we were running Elance today and said, how do we change this business? What would we do? And that's where that conversation started. It was trying to change an existing business, but ultimately led us to create something completely different. Where in our model, rather than bids and proposals, for example, if you need a logo design, you look at 100 different custom logos to your specification for your business, as opposed to 20 bids to do a logo. And that's a very different way for entrepreneurs to buy creative services, to buy logo design, website design, you know, product design. And at the same time, we were able to cut the prices by 10 to 100 times less than what the market was charging at the time, because we were able to create a way for people, service providers, freelancers, great designers who were not working on Madison Avenue, who didn't have potentially a 20-year education level of experience, but who were enormously talented. We gave them an opportunity to find clients. And those clients cared about the quality of design, not where somebody went to school. And it's this nugget that grew into something bigger, where we started working with businesses in 100 countries and Fortune 500 companies and agencies who appreciated that talent is talent. And so that question of how do we do better? How do we get away from using resumes to qualify people, using bids to figure out who should work for us? That question led us to build CrowdSpring. And ultimately, that's one of the questions we always ask now is, what can we do differently?
So 2006, the idea began. 2008, you publicly launched. But for 13 years prior to that, you were an attorney. You were a trial attorney. And I would like to know, what brought you from being a trial attorney to not only just an entrepreneur, but an entrepreneur wanting to develop tech in the graphic design space?
Technology was always a passion for me. Graphic design wasn't always a passion, but was always an interest for me. So in college, for example, I found the storehouse of Advertising Age magazines dating back decades. And I spent a year reading most of them, looking at the designs. It was just, to me, fascinating. Advertising was fascinating to me. And so technology, though, has always been fascinating. I started practicing law in 95 when the internet first became commercialized. And so I had a chance to become entrepreneurial in my legal practice. I founded new legal practices at the two firms where I was a partner in electronic discovery. And then I did a lot of work with startups and technology companies. And that led me to be passionate about that industry. But really, CrowdSpring came about as an accident. In fact, it's how most entrepreneurs end up launching businesses. I ran into a problem. I was redesigning my firm's website, a mid-sized Chicago law firm, and did what most law firms do. I put together a request for proposals, interviewed firms, hired one, paid them a lot of money, and hated the work they did. And struggling to figure out, how do we overcome this? This is the traditional problem. You hire somebody, they do the work, and the work sucks. And so struggling to overcome that and embarrassed, I went home and I said, there's got to be a better way for businesses and entrepreneurs to buy design services. Because I also saw at the same time my clients who I was representing in the internet space, in the technology space, struggling with this question too. They were spending tens of thousands of dollars on design that just didn't look good. And so that process led to a lot of research and thinking and ultimately led me to found CrowdSpring.
Wow. From getting an RFP to getting the work done and paying a lot of money and hating the work that was done. And like, it is that pain point that you wanted to scratch that itch. But my guess is you haven't. But have you ever thought about going back to that company and just thanking them for doing such terrible work?
I haven't. And ultimately, listen, they're representative of so many other companies. And this is one of the challenges. This is one of the, I think, lessons we learned and maybe secrets we unlocked when we launched CrowdSpring to help democratize design. It used to be there was this vanguard that was guarding design. So you had to work with an agency. You had to work with an established designer, especially if you were an established company. And those people charged a lot of money. And it wasn't that the work was terrible. Visually, the work was okay. It's that they were used to building cookie cutter websites. And this was in 2004, 2005. And so they built the same kinds of cookie cutter websites for everybody. And the one thing that every single client wants is something unique, something different. We didn't want a cookie cutter website. And of course, we explained this to them, but their business was built on cookie cutter websites. And a lot of agencies at the time, a lot of freelancers at the time had a particular style, and that's the style they used. And so what we ended up uncovering when we launched CrowdSpring was this world of talent, designers, product designers, web designers around the world who didn't build cookie cutter websites, didn't create cookie cutter logos because they had different cultural upbringings, different language upbringings. They lived in different countries. They brought something different to the mix. And so rather than working with the agency next door who charged us a lot of money, this is in the six figures for this work. Today, we can do this for under $1,000.
Oh, I mean, and it's funny because, I mean, in 2020, it seems so normalized. I'm sure everybody listening is just like, well, yeah, that's how you get design done now. But again, 14 years ago, this was not the case. And we've seen it. And some of us have got to let now only exist within like a market that this is how it can be done. From freelancing from almost, I mean, anything you need done, but design specifically, there are a lot of places that do it now. And I think even bigger companies, as you would probably know, have gone this direction where they can just, they don't need to hire those big agencies anymore. It's just not the way it needs to be done. And it's almost, not only does it not need to be done, but it's kind of like, why would you even do it that way? Because you get typically not as good of work for way more money.
Well, that's how we started working with agencies, actually. It's a funny story. We when we launched, we had agencies initially reacted negatively because they saw us as competition. And our response was that yes, we may be competition for some clients who are really not your clients, but we're an asset for you for other clients because you can now, without additional capital expenses, use CrowdSpring to create all sorts of graphic design and web design and product design that you couldn't otherwise and provide strategy work to clients. And when they resisted, clients started calling us directly. So we had CMOs of Fortune 50 companies calling us directly saying, my agency is resisting working in this new model, but we'd like to test it for ourselves. And the funny part of the story is that within weeks, we had many big agencies. I mean, the world's best agencies calling and partnering with us to work together because they saw the writing on the wall. They saw their clients testing this model. They recognized that this would be challenging for them if clients decided to skip the middleman effectively and use CrowdSpring or other companies directly. And they also recognize that there is value for them, that they had provided strategy and that was their key insight that we could not provide. But from an execution perspective, from creating design assets, logos, and marketing materials and websites, products, we can do it cheaper, we can do it faster, and in many cases, we can do it better. They still had phenomenal designers, they could still execute well, but this gave agencies a chance to exponentially grow their businesses. And it's why we've worked with so many big and small agencies over the years.
So at the beginning of this conversation, Ross, you said your one thing has been the thing that you're good at is that ability to and strategy to compete with yourself and stay competitive because of that. So now every like expert out there is talking about this 80-20 rule and how you're supposed to do what you're good at and delegate the rest. So let's flip it. And Ross, can you tell me something within your business that you are absolutely not good at?
There are lots of things, most things. So there are two ways to look at it. First of all, and I think there's a way to reconcile them because I am an absolute believer in figuring out what you're good at and when you're able hiring people to do the things that you're not and giving them a lot of autonomy. So, but there is a corollary to that that people don't talk a lot about, which is you need to understand the jobs for which you're hiring before you can start hiring people and delegating. And I think that part of the conversation is often missing. The one thing that, and I'll give you an example. The one thing that I did when we launched CrowdSpring was before we hired a single customer support person, I answered all the tickets for 6 months. And it wasn't because we were trying to save every single penny. It was because we really didn't understand what kind of people we needed to hire. We didn't know whether we'd need help in chat. We didn't know whether we'd need email support. We didn't know what kind of metrics to set up. We didn't know how much time it would take, the voice that we needed to use. And so it's something that I ended up doing myself for a period of time. And I applied that same logic to every other job for which we hired, with some exceptions. I'm not an engineer. I couldn't build the site myself, but I have built websites. And so they're very different skills when you're building a website based on WordPress. Or I used to hand code sites long before these interfaces in 94, 95. But doing something yourself first gives you an understanding of the scope of the work, how it needs to be done, and the kind of people that you need. But absolutely important, once you understand what you need to do, to find people that can do it better than you. Because at most things at our company, at customer support, at marketing, at engineering, there are people that are significantly better than I am. And my role is not to overstep. I hire smart people. I actually don't care. I've started multiple companies. I don't look at resumes ever. I don't care where people went to school, if they went to school. I don't care about their prior jobs, not the things that are listed on the resume. We qualify people a little differently, but I do care about their approach to problem solving. And so I've hired people whose last, as designers, product designers, whose last job was collecting carts at Walmart. I've hired people that never went to school and who were working on hardware, who have become some of the best software engineers in our company. And so that approach really helps. It's important to hire people that are great, but you don't always get to talk to great people at the time they're great. You need to see that future.
Wow. So I like this. So their ability to problem solve, though, is sort of imperative to you.
It's critical. So when we hire, and this is a lesson we learned a long time ago, we ask 4 or 5 questions, and they're all written questions. We don't ask for resumes. People often submit them, but I don't read them. We ask 4 or 5 written questions, and they're simple questions. One of them, for example, is, why do you want to work for CrowdSpring? And we look for several things. First of all, I'm a big believer in hiring people who write really well. Today, business is about content. It doesn't matter whether you're in customer support or in marketing or an engineer. It's all driven by content. But also, back from my career as an attorney, I was in front of juries, in front of judges. I had to explain very complex cases, concepts. A lot of my work was intellectual property, so they were physics concepts, mechanical engineering, difficult concepts, and I was not a mechanical engineer. And I had a huge advantage in my ability to learn and explain in a way that people could understand. And I realized that when people have that kind of an advantage, it makes it much easier to collaborate and communicate. So when I started hiring, I looked for people that could explain those concepts, maybe very difficult concepts that I didn't understand, in a way that I did understand. So I looked for answers that really showed somebody spent some time thinking about it. An answer like, I want to join CrowdSpring because I need a job, won't get me to read the second question and your second answer. So we were looking for unique people, people that had done some interesting things. We wanted to know, you know, kind of problems they've run into and how they've solved them. It wasn't even important that they solved complex problems, because as an entrepreneur, I've started businesses where we've run into huge complex problems we could not overcome. We've had to close those businesses. And so that's not important. What's important is, what was the challenge? How did they approach it? What did they learn? And how did they approach it differently the next time?
I like it. So let's move this, because this sort of follows it, but into projects, if we will. So projects, Ross, can be like, it's a loose term, obviously, whether it's a marketing project or a product project you want to take on. You talked about these quarterly meetings, competing with yourself. You've talked about hiring smart team members and giving them autonomy. But I'd like to know, you have these quarterly meetings to compete with yourself. Ideas are brought to the table. How do you, as the CEO and guiding your team, how do you guys decide that a project is worth not only yours, but your team's time, energy, and resources?
So first of all, our brainstorming on projects starts asynchronously, long before we get into a meeting. We don't have many meetings at CrowdSpring. We have one weekly team meeting that's about 40 minutes, and it's our roadmap where people suggest ideas for how we improve our business, our product, and we talk through those ideas. That's the only scheduled meeting we have as a company. So I'm not a big believer in meetings. I'm a big believer in ideation, but asynchronous ideation. We've done a lot of research on this. I actually, about 5 years back, looked to start a business that would help people and companies ideate. And we actually built the interface for the product and did a lot of research to understand the problem and the concept. And as a former lawyer, of course, this is something that was already pretty close to me. People don't do a good job ideating in a group, in a meeting, when they're sitting around a table with a whiteboard and throwing out ideas. And so we've known this for a long time. We've never started our quarterly meeting, for example, throwing out fresh ideas so we can start discussing them. Instead, a month or so before we start, we use Basecamp as our project management tool. We've been a happy Basecamp customer ever since we started from 2006. But we start that ideation a month or so earlier. We start the conversation asynchronously. Somebody will post a message suggesting an idea. Somebody else will give some feedback. We'll do a bit of research and we'll go back and forth. Sometimes 20, 30, 40, 50 messages back and forth before we ever get into the same room or on the same call to start talking about it. And that really helps us do two things. First of all, in-person ideation is risky because some people have a tough time doing it. They're intimidated by others. It's also hard for some people to think in real time with everything that's going on. Most people find it easier to kick back and consider some of the challenges and proposals and cross-reference them and take a minute to think about some of the ways that could move forward. And so asynchronous ideation for us has always been part of our culture. And so when we get into that quarterly meeting, we've already talked about something for quite a bit of time. This is never the first time where we raise an issue. And for us, we're at the 80% mark where we've already 80% there. We've decided whether it makes sense for us to continue and potentially plan a new feature or a new product or a new marketing strategy, or if we've gotten to the point where we have to cut bait and say, this isn't going to work for us. It's rare that we'll get into something and all of a sudden it comes up for the first time. And where it does, we generally try to still ideate as much as we can asynchronously.
And I would assume that a lot of ideas, as they're going through that 40 or 50 back and forths in the ideation stage, just stop somewhere early on.
They do. So we try to do a good job of managing that process. And if a conversation starts, of course, it could digress in multiple different directions. And so we all do a pretty good job of getting to a point where we say, let's decide what we're going to continue talking about and let's stop talking about the things that we don't think make sense. That's really important too, because it's really important to say no to the things that are going to waste your time. And that's across the board as an entrepreneur. You're going to end up saying no much more often than you're going to say yes. But particularly when it comes to ideation, you can spend a lot of time ideating on things that may be interesting, intellectually informative, but would do nothing to help your business. And so we really hold ourselves accountable to make sure that when we ideate, it's relevant, it could be meaningful to our business, it's something that we could legitimately potentially implement in the next 6 months, or at least start implementing in the next 6 months. Again, I don't want to be ideating about something 2 years from now. I have no idea what's going to happen 2 years from now. And I think the world generally doesn't know what's going to happen either, given the year we're living through this year. It's been a surprise to everybody. So for our company, I think for most entrepreneurs, for most smaller businesses, thinking in 3 to 6 month increments, and for some, that's even too long. Some just want to think about 6 weeks or 4 weeks.
Yeah. I mean, there was a time, March, April, May, where people were having trouble planning a week in advance because literally everything was changing week to week, it seemed. And some companies, like you said, that were planning 2 years in advance at that point, they had to completely stop that, unlearn how to do that, and start trying to learn or plan on almost a day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month basis like you guys were already doing.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, listen, when you have very complex events, so the pandemic obviously was a very unique, unnatural event that disrupted everybody. You have to do things differently. The question wasn't so much how do we compete with ourselves at the time when we ran into this pandemic. I was monitoring things in February already. I was a little bit ahead of the government. I told my kids, I had two kids in college, and I told them they'll be coming home for spring break, but not going back to school, regardless of what the schools were going to decide. And so the question we were asking ourselves wasn't so much how do we compete against ourselves, but what do we need to do very quickly to structure our business so that we can ride through what looked to be very challenging times and an unknown period of time, because nobody knew and still nobody knows today how long this situation is going to last. And so that required a very different approach, but it didn't change the mindset of how we did it. We didn't get into a room and start brainstorming. We did it asynchronously. We started these conversations again in Basecamp, and we went through and then we focused on the ideas that we thought made the most sense.
So in February, did you have any internal sort of struggles bringing people on board with the idea that this was going to be big, even though the government really at that time wasn't saying that?
Most people didn't believe that it was going to be big and that we were going to be in for a nasty situation. But ultimately, we're a small business. We have a small team. We have a big community. So we have 10 people. And we have a community of probably 350,000 freelancers and clients in 100-plus countries, freelancers in 195 countries. And so for ourselves, there were things that didn't jar us very much. We have been a remote team for years. We've been a remote team since the day we started. We've had an office from time to time, but 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we actually decided to give up our office because it made little sense for us. Everybody was located all over the world, and I was the only one left in Chicago. And so there were things that businesses faced, there were challenges businesses faced, we did not. We already knew how to work collaboratively remotely. We were already using those tools. We already trusted each other and held each other accountable for the work we were doing. Our community of freelancers was all remote. Our clients effectively relative to us were all remote. So, but the challenges that related to businesses going out of business and struggling and budgets being cut obviously impacted everybody, us included. And so we had to deal with those kinds of realities. And I think our team understood that we needed to focus on that first and make sure that we were in a position to weather that storm. And that meant we put aside some of our plans for that quarter. Whatever we planned for that quarter, we set aside and said, you know, that's not our plan anymore. Our plan is to ride through this turmoil.
And yeah, and then see where it goes from here. But being remote already definitely puts you at an advantage enormously. So once again, you were ahead of the curve, much like CrowdSpring has been most of the time, it seems.
Yeah, I think part of it was luck. Part of it was just, we made choices that we thought made sense. We wanted better quality of life for people. We were never the 80-hour work week company. We thought there was important to balance. Creativity is important, regardless of what you do, whether you're an engineer or a designer. And so we wanted to empower people to be creative in their lives.
Well said. So I've really enjoyed this, Ross. I do want to wrap up on one final question for you, if I could. It's this idea I've been working with calling the entrepreneurial gap. So there seems to be this place, this gap sort of that we live in as entrepreneurs, as dreamers, Ross, where no matter what we accomplish personally, professionally, we're always sort of projecting our successes into the future. So in 3 months, when you hit that revenue metric, or in 6 months, whatever it happens to be, you and I both know that just seconds before you hit that, we're just going to set bigger, loftier goals. And I agree, we do. There's a place for looking ahead and pushing. But let's not do that. We've talked about crowdsource for the last half hour, but we haven't heard nearly all the highs, lows, wins, and losses. But I'd love to know, if you could stop and turn around and look behind you, how do you feel about this journey up until today?
It's an interesting question. So for me, I have mixed feelings about it. It's been definitely a tough journey. The one thing I didn't appreciate was how lonely entrepreneurship is, how difficult it is. I worked very hard as an attorney. In my 13 years, I was by far the top biller in my two firms, except for 1 year where the person who outbilled me ended up detaching his retinas from reading too much and spent 3 weeks in the hospital. So I was used to working hard, but I don't think that compared to what it took to build a business. Building a business is extremely hard. And so part of that is I'm proud that I've been able to embrace that and overcome those challenges. We've done well with CrowdSpring. We definitely haven't done nearly as well as I had hoped. there have been many challenges. Part of the challenge is, I think, typically as a young entrepreneur, when we started the business, I didn't appreciate the importance of product. So we thought if we can create enough buzz and had a different platform and vision and values and all that other stuff, that would take care of itself. And of course, most entrepreneurs, after a few years, learn that just doesn't happen. People love great products. Companies like Apple and Tesla and many others show that. And so it took a while to understand that, and we've been really focusing hard. So mixed feelings. I think we've done a lot of things wrong. I think we've done a lot of things right. And I think it's hard to be an entrepreneur, to continue to look for success, to continue to work hard, unless you have mixed feelings. I think if you feel like you've achieved everything you could possibly achieve, you're not hungry enough. You're not determined enough to do more. And so people that are still driven, people that are still working hard, people that are still creating, that are inventing, always look back and say, I could have done better. I could do better. I will do better.
Very well said. Very well said. So as I said, we've talked about sort of CrowdSpring throughout this, but now could you, Ross, just specifically tell the listener what CrowdSpring is and who it can help and where they can find it online?
Sure. CrowdSpring helps entrepreneurs, businesses, agencies, and nonprofits with logo design, graphic design, web design, and product design, and also business naming for every stage of their growing business. We have a community of 220,000 designers and product designers and namers helping businesses all over the world. And we believe that design doesn't have to cost tens of thousands of dollars. Projects start from a few hundred dollars. You can find us at crowdspring.com, CrowdSpring.com. We also have a terrific business blog at crowdspring.com/blog, where it's one of the top 30 business marketing blogs in the world, where we spend a lot of time digging into issues of marketing psychology and entrepreneurship and starting and growing a business. And these are, a lot of our articles are meaty. So typically, I think a lot of people are writing 500, 750 word articles. Ours tend to be in the 3,000 to 20,000 range because we believe that we gained a lot of benefit from learning from people. And so we're trying to give that back. We create a lot of content to give back to the community.
Wow, that's awesome. So crowdspring.com is the site, or crowdspring.com/blog. I will link to both of those in the show notes for you so they're easy to find. Ross is also on LinkedIn and on Twitter. A few other things we discussed during the call, I'll also add links to in the show notes so they're all easy for you to find. But make sure if you need design work done, check out CrowdSpring. Ross, once again, thank you so much for stopping by. I truly, truly appreciate it. Thanks for sharing so openly. And just keep doing what you guys are doing because it is really awesome to watch.
Appreciate it, and good luck to everybody listening.
All right, that was a lot of fun. I hope you dug that nearly as much as I did. Don't forget to check out LinkedIn Marketing, right? LinkedIn.com/hack. You'll get $100 free ads to get started. Make sure to check that out, because without our sponsors, we really couldn't be here. So yeah. So if you want some free advertising, that's your place to go. All right. Well, it's been an absolute blast. I do thank you for stopping by. Hacktheentrepreneur.com. That's our website. You can track us down over there if you want. Check out the blog. Check out Ross's show notes, or, you know, just get onto the email list and see what we can offer you if you wish. All right. It's been great. I truly, truly appreciate you stopping by. And please, until next time, keep hacking the entrepreneur.